This is the State of Things from the Museum of Natural Sciences in downtown Raleigh. I'm Frank Stacio. You know, it's not often that a state's budget director is a household name, but that is the case here in North Carolina. Governor Pat McCrory appointed Art Pope to be his state budget director last year, but he has been a prominent and well-known figure in the state for many years, served four terms in the North Carolina House of Representatives, also chairman and president of Variety Wholesalers, a retail chain with more than 350 stores around the Southeast, including Rose's and Maxway stores in North Carolina. Art Pope is a major financial player in the state. His family foundation donates millions of dollars every year. He's also received strong criticism for how his money has influenced state politics. He's a North Carolina native whose philosophies and vision are both influential and controversial, and he joins us in the studio today. Art Pope, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So you were born in Fayetteville, but then spent most of your young life in Fuquay Varina, or what is now Fuquay, I guess.
My family lived in Fuquay, a small town in eastern North Carolina, but my mother grew up in Fayetteville and used to work in Highsmith Hospital. So when it came time for her children to be born, rather than traveling west to Raleigh, she traveled back east to her old hospital where she used to work. But I grew up in Wake County.
Tell us about growing up.
Again, I started off in Fuquay. It's a small town. It was a tobacco market back then when that was really important to the economy. September tobacco markets are almost more important than Christmas time. But I did move to Raleigh in the 1960s, attended both public school in Raleigh. Also went to a private school for my high school education. And from there, I went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And after Chapel Hill, went to Duke Law School.
Everybody we've talked to says you are deeply interested in political philosophy and the sort of the underlying philosophies and theories in politics. When did you start having an interest in politics?
Probably primarily in high school. I had a really good history teacher, and he actually started teaching John Locke in high school. And so I first read two treatises in government back when I was a high school junior. I didn't understand the introductory explanation by the college professors, but I actually could read Locke's own writings, and that gave me a fairly good idea. So when I went to UNC, my father wanted me to be a business major, but instead I was a political science major and got a degree with honors in political science. And when I went to law school, it's in part because that, in ways, applied political theory. And had excellent teachers at Duke as well, including for jurisprudence.
Your father did own a business, a chain of stores that he took over from his father, wanted you to go into business. What was your sense of being getting into business? I mean, was it no way, or was it just more interested in politics?
Not so much interested in politics, but I was interested in law. And again, political science, political theory formed the background. But I was very interested in being my own person, being self-supporting, and to me, a law degree offered that best opportunity. And indeed, when I came time that I graduated from Carolina, my father wanted to be an MBA school, but I chose to go to law school. My father's a big Tar Heel fan. I went to Duke, no less. I do want to say, though, because there's been some comments about this. My father's always very supportive of all his children. He was very clear what he thought was best, but he was also very supportive for us making our own decision. And I did go into law practice for a couple of years here in Raleigh. And then, though, when I got an opportunity to work in the Jim Martin campaign in 1984, it's the first time I really got fully involved in politics, took a leave of absence from my law firm to do that. And then when Governor Martin became governor, I was his special counsel for state boards and commissions and agencies back in 1985. And that was a mid-level position, but it was a great opportunity for public service to actually accomplish some things and learn and listen a lot.
Jim Martin, of course, a Republican governor, the last Republican governor before the current governor, Pat McCrory. You worked for him. He was a guy who believed in lower taxes. What did you learn from him, and what did you learn about government in, you know, when you actually got the job?
Well, first of all, I learned you can be in politics, you can serve an elected office and be an absolutely moral, upright gentleman or woman. A lot of times, and again, I grew up during Watergate. I was not a fan of Richard Nixon, by the way. And Watergate just absolutely horrified me. That's one reason I didn't join the Republican Party when I turned 18. But Jim Martin showed you could be honest, committed, and have good government. So that was one of the very first positives. Jim Martin was a pragmatist. He was conservative, but he was a pragmatist. He was a Republican governor with a Democratic majority legislature. And so I learned very early on you had to work with the majority, and you had to work not to compromise principles, but take one step at a time to accomplish your common goals.
I got to take you back a couple of steps because when you were studying political science at UNC Chapel Hill, you helped found the Libertarian Party, which I understand you ran away screaming from not too long after those founding days. Tell us about that.
It lasted a couple of months. Again, in 1972, the Republican Party, I think, was just absolutely torn apart by Watergate. And back in 74, 1976, there are a lot of people thinking the Republican Party would not survive. And so even people like conservative Senator Jesse Helms were looking at possibly a third party. So when I was a college sophomore, I was looking at what the alternate possibilities were, and I was reading a magazine called Reason Magazine and heard there was going to be a meeting of this Libertarian Party in Raleigh. So I went there with a couple of my friends. So since I came with three or four people, I was a, quote, leader, even though I was 20 years old at the time. So, yes, I was actually a founding member of the Libertarian Party at that meeting, and I stayed with it for about 4 or 5 months through May of that year. And the more I saw about it, I thought the people were well-intentioned but not very practical, so I terminated my relationship.
Well, it wasn't very practical to be a member of the Republican Party back then. Jesse Helms certainly successful, and Jim Martin did win. But why Democrats in the state got famously relatively conservative in some ways. Why not become a Democrat in the state of North Carolina back then? Why did you decide to become a Republican?
Well, a lot of people may not realize this now, but during the 60s and 70s, really for most of the 20th century, if you wanted to be successful in North Carolina, you needed to be a registered Democrat. Culturally, we're a Democratic state. Politically, we're a Democratic state. If you want to be a lawyer, if any hope of being a judge, you were a Democrat. However, my family, my father actually was a Democrat, a lifelong Democrat as well. But while I was horrified by the Republican Party of Richard Nixon Watergate, I saw early on that the Democratic Party, especially at the national level, was growing government, was losing respect for the rights of the individual, and I did not see that as being sustainable in the long term. I thought it was consuming itself. So very early on, I was a small C conservative in the libertarian tradition, or the classical liberal tradition, as I would say. And there I found that the Republican Party was far closer to that and far more open to that than the Democratic Party was. So, yes, in a way, I've always been on the side of the underdog, because Republicans were the underdog for 140 years until they won their majorities jumping ahead to 2010.
A minority party, perhaps, but now people would say that that Republican Party really represents the interest of very few, very influential people who could hardly be called underdogs when you see the amount of influence.
I completely disagree with that characterization. The Republican Party in 2010 won 59% of the vote in North Carolina to 40%, 41% by the Democratic Party. That was a vote of 1.4 million people versus 950,000 for the Democrats. You look at the history of the Democratic Party, they've had large major donors, probably more so than Republicans. You look at the most money being spent in campaigns in North Carolina, that was by John Edwards, who spent $6 million for his U.S. Senate campaign in, I can't remember the year, 1998. Mm-hmm. And then Erskine Bowles, when he ran for the U.S. Senate, he spent $6 million. So you want to look to the large donors trying to influence elections. You have to look at the Democratic Party, not the Republican Party in North Carolina.
Well, you mentioned 2010. The Republican-controlled legislature, of course, began the process of redistricting. You were co-counsel of the leadership, but let's talk about the amount of money that was spent. Because in that race, there were three organizations that you were a part of and donated to that represented 72% of the outside spending on legislative races in the state of North Carolina came from three organizations that you either sat on the boards of or donated to. Art, you influenced the top three in that race.
In 2010, you know, to start with the numbers, the Democratic Party spent $15.3 million, according to the North Carolina Board of Election, the Democrat Party and its legislative candidates. That contrasts the Republican Party that only spent $11.6 million. So the Democrats were outspending Republicans. Now, you add in what you're talking about, the independent expenditures, mm-hmm. and there were independent expenditure groups supporting the Democrat Party as well as conservative groups supporting Republican candidates or who characterize as supporting them. When you add in the independent expenditures, the Democrat Party plus the independent expenditures by progressive organizations, the NCAE, the union affiliates for the teachers, they spent $17.5 million. Whereas for the conservatives and Republicans, they spent $13.6 million. So the most money was spent by the Democratic Party and the pro-union progressive organizations combined compared to the Republican Party and the pro-business and conservative groups combined. It was a competitive election.
Real Jobs NC, Civitas Action, Americans for Prosperity, you helped start them all in North Carolina. Counted, those are three groups. 72% of the independent spending in that race, the independent spending, came from organizations that you were on the board of or helped found. So we can talk about the numbers of millions of dollars, but three groups, 72% of the independent spending on a crucial race. And so I will say it is wisely spent because it was on legislative races that would then become redistricting races. So the Democrats may not have spent too smart. Three groups, 72% of the independent spending. Art Pope, that was you.
And the Reynolds Foundation, which finances Blueprint NC, Democracy NC, spent about $2 million on civic engagement, voter registration, get out the vote. Reynolds Foundation, controlled by Leslie Winter, a former Democratic state senator, just as I'm a former Republican House member. But you don't hear about their spending.
Well, this spending actually went directly into campaigns that I'm talking about, not to outside organizations.
No, they did not go directly into campaigns. They went to electioneering communications and issue advocacy, which is informing the public, informing the voters about how legislators voted when they were in the legislature. It was not expressed advocacy. It did not go directly to campaigns. It would have been illegal for them to go directly to campaigns. So I respectfully have to disagree as a matter of fact and law about your characterization.
We'll come back and we'll talk about how that money was spent and the impact it had when we continue our conversation with Art Pope on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the Museum of Natural Sciences in downtown Raleigh. I'm Frank Stasio, talking today with Art Pope, North Carolina State Budget Director. All right, before the break, Art, we're talking about how that money was spent in 2010. Just to go through it again, Real Jobs NC, $1.5 million into that race, those races, Civitas Action and Americans for Prosperity, $300,000 plus something like that, close to $400,000. Top three independent groups spending on that race. And you were saying, well, there were education campaigns, right? But I mean, you're soft-pedaling it. It was about, when you're talking about somebody's voting record, you're really telling voters who they voted for. This becomes a kind of an election or an ad, a campaign ad, when you're directly targeting somebody's voting record who's running for election. Isn't that a campaign ad?
It's not a campaign ad when it's not for expressly electing or defeating a candidate. It's about the First Amendment, just like your radio show. I'm sure you talked about candidates during 2010 elections. Did you ever interview people about the campaign going on during 2010? Well, you were broadcasting a radio show about the elections, and that broadcast may have influenced people on how they voted. So just as UNC Chapel Hill Radio, UNC Public Broadcasting, and not to mention the News and Observer, WRL-TV, they can spend money broadcasting, communicating with the voters. They even endorse candidates outright, the News and Observer does. That is communicating with the public. That is part of our civic life. And that is exactly what American First Prosperities and the other groups do as well.
So when you have that money and you spend it, and let's see, targeted races, 27, 20 of them were successful. 20 won by Republicans, 20 were won, victories that is, by Republicans in 27 races that were targeted. So that campaign, designed to educate the voters, resulted in 20 victories for Republicans, and that was money that you spent on that. So when people say, because I know that sometimes you take umbrage when people accuse you of using your money and influence to influence the political process unduly. And this is what they mean, Art. This is exactly what they're talking about.
Well, Frank, first of all, let's be precise. When you say your money, I did not spend $1.5 million or $300,000. Groups I was associated with and glad to support spent that money. just as a teacher affiliated with the NCAE spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on the election, and just as McClatchy Corporation, through its publication of News and Observer, gosh knows how much it costs to publish a newspaper with its news coverage, but also endorsements of there. So let's be precise. Yeah, I do take umbrage when you imply that I spent a million or millions of dollars when I did not. I'm associated with the Republican Party. Again, let's put it in context. You want to ignore this. The Democratic Party and all those affiliated with or tied to the Democrat Party spent $15.3 million on its legislative races to $11.6 million for Republicans. And again, the progressive groups, when you combine that to Democrats, still outspent the Republican conservative groups. But despite the Democrat Party, the progressive organizations, pro-union spending the most money, they didn't buy the money. They didn't buy the election with that money. Instead, the voters were well-informed by a wide variety of sources, including mailers and TV ads and newspapers and your radio show, and they chose overwhelmingly by 59%. To vote for Republicans. They voted for Republicans because of the failed policy of the Democratic Party, because of corruption in the Democrat Party, which the primary example is Jim Black. They were ready for a change. That is the way democracies work.
Jim Black, by the way, House Speaker, who was ultimately jailed for taking bribes. That's who you're referring to, and you're absolutely right. Democratic House Speaker. Let's talk about the organizations that you founded. Real Jobs NC, as you said, that spent $1.5 million on that race. Variety Wholesalers, the corporation that you're now CEO of, a family corporation, gave $200,000, gave $36,005 to the Republican State Leadership Committee that spent the that gave $1.5 million to Real Jobs. Why set up Real Jobs? And Americans for Prosperity. What was your goal in organizing those groups here in the state of North Carolina?
Well, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to correct the record. I did not found Real Jobs NC. It was founded by other individuals. I was one of the early board members. My company did contribute to it. As an example, my company's contribution were about $200,000. But they spent a total of about $1.7 million. Yet sometimes people attribute the entire $1.7 million as it came from me, which is not correct. Again, Real Jobs NC, as its name says, it wanted to point out what creates real jobs. How do we alleviate poverty, not by simply having handouts for temporary help, but have a state where we can have permanent job growth through less regulation, lower taxes, so people can keep more of their own hard-earned paycheck, how they can afford to start their own business and create jobs. So that's what Real Jobs was about. Americans for Prosperity has been a long-time grassroots group. I can't remember the exact number of activists it had in 2010, but I think it was well over 100,000. And it gives an opportunity for people of all parties, whether you're Republican, Democrat, or Independent, to come together in support of their issues. So it is expressly nonpartisan, and over half its members, I think, were Independents or Democrats, not Republicans.
You started your terms in the legislature, four of them in all, in 1988, elected to the General Assembly, when the Republicans were in a minority and you were actually elected from a district in Wake County that was pretty much a majority Democrat. Tell us about that victory and about your time in the legislature when it was dominated by Republicans.
Well,
Democrats, I should say.
After serving with Governor Martin in 1985, I did go into business in 1986. And the legislature, again, has been Democratic since the Reconstruction. So I did want to serve. I mean, I heard Senator Floyd McKissick speak about why he believed in public service as a calling, because we want to make our government better, more effective, better serve the people. I share the same goals that the Democrat candidates do. We may disagree on how to do that, but I did run for a House District 61 against a four-term incumbent Democrat, a Democrat-leaning district. And I ran on issues. I ran on my qualifications for office as a lawyer, a business person, someone that served Governor Martin, but on the issues. Because if I ran on party affiliation, then the Democrat candidate would have won. He was an incumbent, and they did have the Democrats outnumber Republicans 2-1. So I won my first office with support from Democrats, and I always ran in a Democrat-leaning district. And I've always looked to Democrats as well as Independents and Republicans. And just, again, my parents were Democrats. I grew up in a Democratic family.
What was it like to work in that legislature? Again, you're working in the minority with a long history of Democrats in control. Was it frustrating? How difficult is it to be a minority party trying to get things done?
It was not frustrating. It was more challenging. But in fact, that year in 1989, Republicans formed a coalition with dissident Democrats and elected Joe Mavretic as a coalition speaker, overturning Liston Ramsey. Liston Ramsey had been speaker for four terms, was ruling the legislature with an iron fist, was not allowing open meetings, a true small D Democrat process. So we formed that coalition. So again, one of my first lessons I learned with Governor Martin was working a Democrat majority. As a member of the Republican minority party, forming a coalition of dissident Democrats to form a majority. But there, even after that, and again, Dan Blue was speaker my second term. He was a regular Democratic speaker, but he was someone I got along with very well and respected. You work on a one-on-one basis with the legislators to both parties. You try and come up with policies that actually solve problems and get bipartisan support for it. And also, you don't care who gets credit. Republicans used to complain if they had a good bill, it would never see the light of day until it appeared with a Democrat co-sponsoring a different bill. That didn't matter to me. If good legislation got passed, it got passed. And in my first two terms, I was able to pass the first open meetings law that applied to the General Assembly. But I did that with Democratic Representative George Miller, had a similar bill, and we combined our bills, and he supported and got enacted the law. I was actually one of the authors to what we now call the Rainy Day Fund in 1991. That's working with a Senator Goldston from Eastern North Carolina, Democratic senator who had the measure on the Senate side. When he couldn't get any support on the Senate side, then I make some progress on the House side, then, okay, well, we can't let the House do it first, and the Democrats will move it through. My actual bill failed, but it got included as an amendment to the overall state budget. That's how you make legislation work, whether you're a minority or the majority.
You actually got ratings as a fairly effective legislator in your first term for the amount of legislation you got passed as a minority legislator, rated pretty effectively by the press corps that year, we found out. So you ran for lieutenant governor in 1991. You lost that race. That's the mid-90s. Then you sought the chief of staff job for then-Speaker Brubaker, unsuccessful there.
Frank, that's not correct.
Did I get it wrong?
Yes, you did. I did not seek a job from the speaker nominee at the time, Harold Brubaker. Harold Brubaker, who I served with the House, approached me at a job. We had discussions, and the job he ended up proposing, I actually turned down. So, again, appreciate the opportunity to correct the record.
Well, we'll check that source, but that's how we've got it here, so I'm going to stand by it for a moment, but I appreciate that.
What is
that.
Your source? I was there. I had discussions with Speaker Brubaker, so I'm curious what your source are. I know it's a story put out by Richard Morgan, who's not exactly a big fan of mine, but Richard Morgan was not there in that conversation.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is what you learned from all of that. There's these discussions going on now to get at sort of the some levels of control within the Republican Party to move up in the leadership circles of the Republican Party. You were nominated for lieutenant governor, but lost that race. Where did you think your political career was going at that point?
Well, you take a step back, and again, I was a freshman in 1989-90 session. By the 1991-92 session, my second term, I was elected Republican Joint Caucus Leader by members of the House and the Senate. So I was one of the top leaders within the Republican Caucus, House and Senate, that term. I ran for Lieutenant Governor. I actually won a three-way Republican primary by a 10% margin and running against two more experienced Republican legislators. 1992 was not a good year. I got the same vote as our candidate for governor and president that year, so that's the way elections work. They get decided that way. But I was trying to balance back then and really trying to balance today being involved in public service. And you term politics, but politics is usually about public service. But being involved in public service, trying to raise a family and be in business, I've done a constant balancing act since then. And when I ran for lieutenant governor, it's always a decision to do it full-time or very little part-time because I just could not continue in the legislature and with my family and business at the same time. So from 92 till 1999, I stayed in private life. In 1999, Chuck Neely, who held my old legislative seat, stepped down to run full-time for governor. So I was asked to serve again, which I did, ran again in 2000. 2002, if you want this much detail, but in 2001, the legislative session went from January till December. In 2002, it went from the so-called short session from April to November. And I just could not keep up that pace, even with the advantage of living in Raleigh and raise a family and take care of the family business.
Tell us about founding the John Locke Foundation, the conservative think tank that you've created, 1990. What was that all about? What was the genesis of that for you?
Well, I first thought about it in 1985 when I was special counsel to Governor Martin. Governor Martin was actually the second Republican after Jim Holzhauser. But there really were no good policy proposal, good sources of information, knowledge, research for him to build an agenda as an alternative to the status quo Democratic agenda. There was a group already in North Carolina called the North Carolina Center for Public Policy, funded by the Reynolds Foundation, and they did some excellent work. But no matter what the issue was, you could count the solution being regulate more, spend more, and raise taxes to pay for spending and regulation. So there was no alternative, no balance to the North Carolina Center for Public Policy. In fact, Governor Martin had us go to Tennessee to work with Lamar Alexander for education reform proposal. He'd only been there 2 years longer than we had as a Republican governor in Tennessee. So looking at the national level of models like the Heritage Foundation, I thought would help North Carolina's public policy debate to have an alternative voice. And so when I was in a position to do something with that, with the Polk Foundation providing seed money, we started the John Locke Foundation, and as you said, in 1990.
Well, you know, we talked about that race in 2010, the money that was spent, back and forth on that, and a lot of different ways to look at the way the money was spent. But the net effect was Republicans did gain control, and it was a crucial year when it came to redistricting, of course, and now you've heard a lot of complaints about the fact that the gerrymandering, which is done every 10 years by every party in power, has really created some safe districts for Republicans and tipped the balance. What do you say to the charges that, particularly when we look at the number of votes cast for Democratic national representatives, members of Congress in the 2012 election, far exceeding those for Republicans, and yet the Republicans retain control of the House because of redistricting. Has this gotten out of control, redistricting?
I've always been opposed to gerrymandering redistricting. That's why in 1989 I introduced legislation co-sponsored Representative Skip Stam for a nonpartisan redistricting commission before we knew we'd have a majority for the 91 redistricting. 1999, I did the same thing again. I introduced legislation for a nonpartisan redistricting commission before we knew it was going to have the majority. And I've been involved in litigation, including the Shaw v. Reno litigation, went up to the United States Supreme Court to uphold the original 12th district, went from Gastonia back then, Gastonia and Charlotte, to Greensboro and Durham, was an unconstitutional racial gerrymandering. So I've always been opposed to that. Likewise, in 2001, I was one of the plaintiffs in the Stevenson litigation, which said that rather than allowing the legislature just draw districts however they wanted to, gerrymander them, you had to follow the Constitution for what's called the whole county provision, not necessarily split counties, as long as you were in compliance with the federal law, including one person, one vote, and the Voting Rights Act. So I have a long record of opposing that. I'm not sure about that number you threw out, though, because in 2010, when Republicans won 59% of the vote, the majority of the vote, those were districts drawn by the Democratic legislature.
The 2012 election, the
2012 legislative elections, I believe the Republicans still got the majority of the votes, well, the majority of the seats. Congressional election, those districts are gerrymandered. There's two things. They're partly drawn in compliance to the Voting Rights Act. This is a very complex legal issue, so I'm just going to give you a short summary. But under the Voting Rights Act, you cannot break up concentrations of minority voters in order to submerge them into surrounding majority voters so they cannot have effective representation. And there's a theory called retrogression as well. Once a majority-minority district is created, an African-American district, you cannot retrogress and reduce it. So not under gerrymandering by the legislature, but under the Voting Rights Act, we have the 12th district and the 1st district, which are majority African-American. And the simple fact is in North Carolina, that means the majority of Democratic voters are concentrated in those districts. When you do that, the consequences are that surrounding districts do tend to be less African-American and more Republican-leaning. So that's right. Part of it. And then there's some old-fashioned gerrymandering, absolutely.
But you served as a special counsel or a counsel to the legislative leadership that was drawing those maps out of the 2010 elections. So what kind of you're opposed to gerrymandering. You say it's not the right thing to do. You're the counsel to this group that's making these kinds of decisions. What did you tell them?
You know very well as an attorney-client privilege, I cannot speak about advice I gave to clients. I will say this, what I did not do, one, I actually did not give any advice on the congressional redistricting, and my legal advice was how to comply with the law.
You know, Tim Heffler was hired to do that, and of course this all came out of Project Red Map that the Republican State Leadership Committee, which spent a lot of money on that 2010 election, a project designed to get control of those maps in 2010. Red Map was the project. Tim Heffler was the map drawer, and he says, apropos of what you said about redistricting, you can go in two directions on this, right? This is not, I'm not quoting Heffler at the moment. You can either draw minorities apart and pack them, disperse them, or you can pack them all into one district and thereby dilute their voting power. Tim Heffler says, quote, in an email, the plan is to incorporate all significant concentrations of minority voters in the Northeast into the first district. That's North Carolina. That sounds like a deliberate attempt to dilute minority votes, get them all in one district, and if they're all voting for a minority candidate to begin with, let's get them out of other districts where there might be a competition.
I think cannot speak for Mr. Heffler and what he was saying then. I can speak for myself, and I'll speak again to the Shaw v. Reno case. That's where I was the lead plaintiff intervener. It was Judge Robinson Everett, who was the lead plaintiff, a Democrat, by the way, and Duke Law professor. And there you saw the absurd 12th district where minority communities spread all over the state in a very contorted fashion were added all in one district, and sometimes the district's only as wide as one lane of Interstate I-85 going up to Piedmont. That was an unconstitutional racial gerrymandering because it was not done to comply with the Voting Rights Act. It was done to create a minority district, African-American majority district, that also didn't hurt adjoining Democrats. And in fact, the Democrat plans for redistricting in both 1991 and 2001 were overturned, not pre-cleared by the Justice Department, because they were not drawn in compliance with the Voting Rights Act, and they were drawn in part to protect white incumbents, Democrat incumbents. And so those are plans I opposed. So the 2011 redistricting plans for both Congress and for the legislature, drawn by Republicans, were the first plans pre-cleared by the Justice Department right out of the box without having to go back and redraw it, unlike the plans drawn by the Democrats in 2001 and 1991. So the Republicans do have a far better record of having less racial gerrymandering. But I repeat my own record. Shaw v. Reno, plaintiff intervener to prevent absurd racial gerrymandering, Stevenson litigation to limit both parties, either party, from drawing members across county lines, drawing districts across party lines to benefit their members. And again, my own record being supported for a nonpartisan redistricting commission, which I still support.
My conversation with Art Pope continues on the state of things in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Today talking with Art Pope, North Carolina State Budget Director, and we haven't talked about the budget yet, so let's do that and talk a little bit about the short-term budget, because that's still in the works, and you're going to have to cross the street pretty soon, I guess, and get ready to work with the short session on making adjustments. But let's talk about the last budget that was passed. There has been a lot of criticism that the state has actually fallen short, that if you look at spending in pre-2008 levels, while the numbers keep going up, we still haven't caught up with the pre-recession numbers. Rather than go straight to the budget, I'll go to the revenue side of that budget, taxes. The state decided to cut taxes, especially corporate taxes and individual income taxes, at a time when it could be rebuilding some of that spending that had been done earlier. And that's a critique. Why cut corporate taxes? Why cut taxes that, particularly for wealthier individuals, at a time when the state could use that money to replenish some of what was lost?
It was not simply a tax cut. It was tax reform. Governors, Governor Hunt, Governor Easley, Governor Perdue, had all been talking about the need for tax reform. Our current tax system, especially the personal income tax, corporate tax, were based on an antiquated system dating back to the 1930s, and they had failed to do so. And taxes and how you tax does affect economic growth. It can restrict slow economic growth or it can speed it up. So we did pass historic tax reform. And the key part of it was lowering and flattening North Carolina's personal income tax rate to a single 5.8%, but also increase the individual exemption to make sure even those at the lowest income levels benefited from as well. Likewise, on the corporate income tax, it was reduced several percentage points over time. So it lowered the taxes. It did broaden the tax base, including by making more uniform. Again, simplicity and uniformity is one of the goals, make the sales tax more uniform, including taxing those transactions that were the store was already collecting a sales tax on the goods, for example, now on the service contract that went with the stereo you bought or the TV. So it's both a broadening and reform. And the goal was to also make taxes simpler but stimulate job growth in North Carolina. And we do think it's been a contributing factor to our dramatic decrease in unemployment rate. It is absolutely true, though, that for a variety of reasons, we have about $450 million less revenue this year than originally forecast by the economists. Part of that, about half of it, identified not to tax reform, but because the 2013 income was collections were lower. And what happened there is, you know, tax rates make a difference. When the federal government increased taxes for 2013, people accelerated realizing their income in 2012 when the rates were lower. Dividends, capital gain, bonus payments, anything they could do to maximize their income in 2012 and minimize in 2013, they did. So that caused us to collect $200 million less than we thought. Likewise, we had forecasts for earnings growth that were lower this year due to the economy, not due to tax collection. And then part of it is the tax collections. But the good news is, for example, the new personal income tax came with a new withholding table. The first time we had a new withholding table since 1989. And because working families are paying less in taxes under that new withholding rate, the amount withheld from state employees' tax increases, from the state employee the amount of state taxes withheld from state employee payroll is about 20% lower. And that hurts the state of North Carolina temporarily, but it helps their family budgets.
Well, there have been a lot of analyses, of course, and you can work the numbers many ways, but there are very few analyses that I saw of the individual income tax changes and reform that didn't show most of the benefits to the wealthiest North Carolinians and few, if any, and as you start to go down the chain, almost no benefit to people in working class and lower. So it may show up on their withholdings, but ultimately most of the analyses that I saw, some showed otherwise, but most of them showed most of the benefits going to the wealthiest. How does that help the state of North Carolina?
Again, I have to respectfully, it is all about numbers, but most of the analyses, I think there's about one analysis put out by the North Carolina Justice Center citing Washington, D.C. group with the absurd claim. Even when you lower everyone's rates, raise everyone's personal exemption, that, quote, 80% of North Carolinians on average or some such were going to be paying more in taxes. Even the Washington Post debunked that number and said that for the campaigns to use that number, it's just wrong. That's not true. So with all due respect, everyone is paying.
I didn't say that, but
okay.
Go ahead.
You did not say. You did not say. Right. You cited many
reports, and they did show that most of the benefits.
Frank, I agree with you. If you're paying in North Carolina, we have a graduated income tax. So if you're paying 7.75% on $100,000, you're going to be paying more in taxes than someone who's paying 6% on $30,000, and obviously paying more tax than someone's paying no taxes. So when you lower the rates, those who pay more in taxes benefit from those who pay no taxes. That's obvious on the income tax.
Well, let's talk about the corporate tax as well, because, again, the question is, who does it benefit, and couldn't we use that money otherwise? Now let's talk about the budget. Effectively, changes in the state's education budget, while nominally more dollars are going in, it has not kept pace with increased enrollment and hasn't kept pace with enrollment and inflation. And so when you look at that, don't you say, let's take in a little bit more money from those who are more able to pay it and spend it on this particular resource that has no way of generating revenue by itself. This is not a money-making proposition. We cannot privatize education because there's no way to monetize and commodify it. So state has to spend on that. Wouldn't it be good to tax a little higher and replenish some of what was lost, particularly through the recession?
Well, I appreciate you recognizing that, at least nominally, as you say, but in fact, spending on education has gone up in North Carolina. In 2008-2009, total spending from the general fund on education was $21.2 billion. And it was actually under Governor Perdue and the Democrats that spending got cut to $18.9 billion in 2010-2011. Now, the reason was obvious, like you said, the Great Recession. But it steadily increased from 2010-2011 under the Republican legislature and the Republican governor so that the authorized budget for all of education now is $20,998,000,000. So that's a good increase. That's about a $2 billion increase over that low point in 2010-11. Have we made up all the way? No. But we have made progress. We have increased spending on education.
Well, I just wonder about this because a number of people have raised this question. Now we'll look at corporate tax. You know, there's something that the reduction in corporate income tax is going to cost the state, according to the General Assembly's own figures and its analysis, somewhere around $217 million. That's $217 million that could have been put into the education budget. North Carolina consistently over the past 10 years is rated number 1, 2, or 3, sometimes 5 in overall business environment, yeah. All the while rating somewhere like 45th in tax, as a tax a place for taxes, meaning taxes are very high here. So clearly if this is a good business environment and you hate the taxes here, taxes can't be the biggest factor in your decision as a corporation. They're moving here. Why cut their taxes when they're happy here and when they're eager to do business here already?
Well, first of all, corporate taxes are down to where they would have been, but the corporate taxes are actually still up this year. So we actually have more corporate taxes this year than we did last year. That would have been more to raise the state higher. Second, I absolutely agree with you that taxes and incentives are not the sole reason a business relocates. The primary reason they locate is proximity to their suppliers, proximity to their customers, and above all, a skilled, educated workforce. So education is key to business recruitment. I think you and I would agree there. However, at the margin, higher tax rates will keep more businesses from moving to North Carolina, but that's not the main reason for tax reform. Existing businesses in North Carolina, when their taxes are lower, they have more after-tax income. That gives them more money to invest in their own business, to expand and create jobs. Unlike tax incentives or business grant incentives for recruiting a big mega corporation from out of state, in state, lower taxes allow all employers in North Carolina. When you say business, you're talking about employers. All employers keep more hard-earned money to invest, create jobs, and yes, spend and create more jobs through spending.
But they don't just create the jobs because they have the money, right? There has to be a market. In other words, there has to be demand for my product. If there's a demand, I have to put more workers on. I might even invest more in plant and equipment. If there's no demand for the product, then I'm not putting workers on, even if you did cut my taxes. And then what I'm going to do with that is invest it. And I'm probably not going to invest in North Carolina because the highest return is probably somewhere in China, where environmental standards are lower and wages are lower. So a lot of that savings doesn't come back to North Carolina. It gets invested, and probably not in North Carolina, unless we're willing to degrade our environmental standards or work standards to pay a higher return.
And when people look at investment, they're looking at the after-tax return. And the higher the taxes in North Carolina, the less attractive it is to keep your own money in North Carolina or invest in North Carolina. So we agree. You need direct spending to create jobs. But by the way, the people who are expanding jobs often do get outside investors. They borrow money. So, again, they need to have a good return on their investment, a business model that allows them to succeed and grow and hire more people, employ more people.
So this becomes, to me, Art, a very interesting kind of political question and a sense of priorities and where they are. If you're in a place where you've had to cut spending, you've written a budget in 2013 that cuts teachers' aides, it's going to increase class size, it's going to degrade student-teacher ratios, they're going to be higher. That's going to mean teachers are laid off, even if they get the pay increase. So quality of education, by those standards, is going to have to fall in the short term. Why is it not a priority? Let me ask the question this way. Why is it not a priority to keep taxes where they are, keep that $217 million plus whatever was added because of improvement in the business environment, and put it into education?
First of all, education is a priority, and I disagree with you. The quality of education was hurt. Compared to the low of spending on education and the teachers laid off under Governor Perdue's administration and the Democrat legislature, the Republican legislature and Governor Corey have increased the number of teachers that were hired.
May I interrupt you? But you did acknowledge that those layoffs and those cuts were a direct result of the recession.
Of course, I do.
Okay, but so there wasn't a heck of a big choice there, and so then when the recession's over, businesses are doing well.
One of the worst recoveries we've ever had, and taxes were raised during the recession as well. You can look at, if you're opposed to regressive sales tax, you're look at all the times they were raised under Democrats. And one of the first things Republicans did in the 2011 legislative session was not lower the personal income tax, not lower the corporate income tax, but not continue the regressive sales tax rate that had been imposed by Governor Perdue and the Democrats. So that helps the economy. That helps everyone. It was only after the sales tax was lowered that then they looked at helping the economy, helping North Carolina families by lowering the personal income tax rate and employers, because a lot of employers pay that personal rate as well as the corporate tax rate. And on education, again, overall spending on education has increased. But it's not merely how much you spend, it's also how well you spend the money. And there's a lot of debate going on whether or not teachers' assistants, especially at grades, second and third grades versus kindergarten, first grade, how much they contribute to education expenditure, the quality of education. And in fact, the General Assembly and Governor's approach was to leave that decision to the local school district. But you can't sit in the legislature in Raleigh and say, I know exactly how much should be spent on teachers' assistants versus actual teachers in Guilford County versus Northampton County, or even within the same schools in Durham County. So that responsibility, that choice left to the local level.
We're talking about leaving a choice to the local level that might be left there. The privilege tax is on the verge of being eliminated. That's a tax that businesses pay in localities and municipalities for the privilege, in quotes, of doing business. It is wildly disparate, and a lot of folks think it needed to be reformed, but what happened in this legislative session is that it was eliminated. Again, from a sort of a free market standpoint, shouldn't the market decide whether that tax is too high? If that business didn't like that privilege tax in Charlotte, leave Charlotte. And if they stay, didn't that tell you that it wasn't too high?
You can argue it both ways from a conservative free market perspective. And in fact, you more often hear the argument at the national level that we have a federal system, and so states compete on tax policy. So North Carolina may have a higher income tax than South Carolina, but we all set it for lower property tax in South Carolina. So you can have the states compete for it. And that same argument can be made among municipalities. On the other hand, you can argue for good government, from conservative principles, that you need uniform taxation and that the laws should be the same, that everyone should be taxed the same throughout the state. And the privilege tax had, like you said, it was treated so differently from one municipality to the next that it was a better principle to have a uniform taxation on that. Also, the municipalities benefited from the tax reform. They were getting more sales tax collections after tax reform than beforehand. So that was revenue to offset the loss of revenue from making the privilege tax more uniform. And Governor McCrory insisted that there be a commitment from the legislature to revisit the issue. It doesn't sunset until June 30th, 2015. So there's a commitment by everyone involved, the League of Municipalities, on behalf of the municipalities, the legislature, and definitely by Governor McCrory to work out what is the best way to have the local revenue raised.
It does seem, low. There's a bit of an inconsistency there. On the one hand, if you say one size fits all doesn't work from Raleigh to every individual school district, then why does one size fit all to every municipality? If you're in Charlotte, there's a very different business environment than Durham. Those are very different places. And if you've moved to Greensboro, you're in a different place again. Shouldn't that be up to them? And ultimately, yes, the market. If that tax was too high, I'm leaving Greensboro. And if I chase out too many businesses, I'm getting rid of the mayor and the city council. It seems to me the market had an answer to that Raleigh might have been not in the best place to make.
That's an appropriate argument to make. It's been made, but I will say one difference is, unlike the states, municipalities and the counties are created by the state. Their taxing authority comes from the state, and because of the wide disparity, and some would even argue abuse, of the privilege tax, it was thought best to go back to a uniform law for everyone on that taxation.
Art Pope, I wish we had more time. A great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for dropping by.
Thank you.
Art Pope is North Carolina's budget director, and that is our program for today. Thanks for listening. If you want to see the facts and figures we talked about, they're on our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Megan Modafferi, Anita Rao, and Will Michaels. Our intern, Charlie Shelton. Robin Copley is the technical director. Al Budarsky's in today. Brent Wolf is our news director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.